This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And this day, like the rest of them this week, is Membership Day at Prairie Public. Ashley Thornburg and I are in studio to remind you that we love our listeners, but members make it possible for us to talk to you.
And it starts that process of membership with a simple phone call. 1-800-359-4145. You can also click and join at prairiepublic.org. And why become a member? Well, if you haven't heard this yet, I'll say it one more time. You probably have noticed that we are not airing commercials. And commercials are a very lucrative form of revenue for places that do air commercials. And so instead, we use the time that would normally be filled up by commercials to have long interviews. We have a two-part interview today coming up on marketing and trade war and how a trade war and tariffs with China are impacting farmers here in North Dakota.
We're lucky because we have these wonderful experts that are at our beck and call occasionally. I mean, Thomas Wall today is going to talk about the trade war and how it affects North Dakota, how it affects the world in general. And he says, you know, it's not checkers, it's chess. It's important we understand the details.
And you can only get into the details of a story like that when you give the expert the time to actually elaborate on things. There's context, there's analysis, and time that would normally be filled up with commercials, we are filling it up with content. But then that means we don't have the money from selling commercials. And that is why we come to you a couple of times a year to ask you to help make that difference when you become a member of this station. Just like when you join your local gym, you have a membership. We have this too. The difference is that you can listen without becoming first, and you can't get very far in a gym without a gym membership. And two, you get to decide how much it is worth to you and how much you can afford. Whatever works for you, 1-800-359-4145.
We know how important you are to us. That's important to share with you as well, because our members are the most important part of our budget pie. They are the biggest single source of funding we have for Main Street and for everything else you hear on Prairie Public. That's why we call ourselves member supported, because members make us possible. So if you've ever thought about becoming a member, today is really a grade A number one day to do that. 800-359-4145, online at prairiepublic.org, or that's that thing you can do with your smartphone, Ashley. You can text,
you can send a text message. The word is support, and the number is 484848, and then we'll send you a link, and then you can fill it out from there. And you are doing so in support of, well, when you do it during Main Street, it's kind of like voting for Main Street.
And we need your vote.
Yeah, and then we get to be like the, you like us, you really like us.
So Sally, make the phone ring.
I can't remember her last name, but we want to hear from you. We want to feel liked. 1-800-359-4145, or click and join at prairiepublic.org. A show like Main Street, where you have these long-form interviews with a special focus on underrepresented voices, like a rural state of North Dakota. We go out of our way to talk to Indigenous people, to women and to children and other voices that don't get heard on the mainstream media. That's a special focus on Main Street, and that's what you're investing in when you call 1-800-359-4145.
Joining me now is Thomas Wall. He's a professor in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at NDSU, and he joins us to talk about the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China, what it means to North Dakota specifically and to our country and the world at large as well. Tom, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
A year into this trade impasse, how would you describe the level of disruption?
Well, in some sectors, disastrous. Soybeans is probably, for North Dakota, soybeans is definitely the worst. For most sectors that have had the tariffs put on, it's been pretty devastating.
Well, what do you see as the most important pain indicators in our country and in China outside of North Dakota?
Well, I guess it's just the level of financial problems that particularly in North Dakota that farmers have suffered because of the loss of markets.
And in the Midwest in general for soybean producers, corn producers, hog producers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And those industries that are allied.
Yeah.
Agribusiness has all kinds of other connections.
Yeah, agriculture and agribusiness in general has been hit the hardest. And I think that was by design by the Chinese because they were big supporters of Trump and they targeted him.
Yeah, it does seem to be politically astute on their part. But let's go across the Pacific and look at China. What are the biggest pain problems they're suffering because of this?
Well, China's a very complex economy, complex country. It's a command economy and there are, you know, they've promoted exports as a way to build their economy. I mean, their goal is to be the number one economy in the world eventually. And part of that strategy was to promote exports. And they did it a number of different ways. One was subsidizing the banking sector, making loans available to certain industries at, you know, lots of loans available. And the big problem there was that, you know, if they didn't pay it back, the government stepped in and covered it. And there's some things I've read that suggest that the banking sector in China has 25% of bad loans, what we would call loans that should be written off. And probably half of them aren't even paying any interest.
So they've got a financial crisis building.
It's building. There's been three banks that they've let go under or been forced to other banks to take over recently, which is a big change in their philosophy in the banking sector.
Now, as you mentioned, China's strategy has been carefully targeted, has put most of the pain where it will cause the most difficulty for the current administration. How effective has our strategy been? Because we've been imposing tariffs against them as well. I mean, has it been as targeted? Has it been as clever?
Well, the initial sets of tariffs were on intermediate goods, inputs into the manufacturing sector. And our manufacturers basically absorbed most of it, if not all of it. But now with the broader scheme of tariffs, consumers are going to see it and pretty readily. You know, when the manufacturing sector absorbs it, it lowers profits, it lowers, you know, the number of people they can hire and slows things down. But when consumers start paying more because of the tariffs, the effects become pretty clear.
Well, the United States has about 350 million people. China has maybe five times as many people. Yeah. And frankly, in my lifetime and certainly in the last generation, an emerging middle class that probably equals the population of our country or our middle class at least. So let's talk about the impacts on the middle class to the middle class in both of these countries.
Well, in China, other than the pork sector, because pork is an important part of their diet.
Yes.
It's culturally and historically. But because of the flu virus, their production of pork has gone way down. So the price of pork has nearly doubled there, and it's projected more than double within a few months. That has probably been the biggest impact directly on consumers in China. Otherwise, you know, some of the stuff that they've imported, you know, like soybeans, an input to the livestock sector, they don't see that directly. And other stuff, it's basically some consumer goods, but a lot of the stuff is available elsewhere. So they haven't had a lot of pain from the tariffs yet.
You're talking about the African swine flu, and as I've been reading that they've had to cull, you know, well over a million hogs so far, but they butchered last year, I think, 700 million, so there's some room, I guess, there yet.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure there's rising concern, and it is being passed on to the consumer.
Yeah.
What do you think about the two principals in this war, that President Donald Trump and the president of China, Xi? One is sort of president for life, or at least assumed to be so. One could argue that, I'm sure. And the other, of course, is looking at election next year. What are their strengths and weaknesses in this ongoing turf battle?
Well, first let me say nobody wins that turf battle. Nobody's going to win a trade war. You know, the idea was that there were some structural changes that we wanted China to make about it. You know, when companies come to China to invest, they were forced to find a Chinese partner or transfer technology. Those are important things that we want changed. But there are many ways to do that. And, you know, Xi is you know, he's very much traditional Chinese. He's not going to make it look like he was defeated. He needs to show a win. And however that happens.
So does Donald Trump.
And Trump does too. And, you know, what does a win mean? You know, for the U.S., what does a win mean?
I guess that's where the politics steps in. You've got to sell it, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
There's also another element here that sort of goes way beyond my pay scale but is pretty important, and that is the strength of the U.S. dollar and the recent devaluation somewhat of the Chinese yuan.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that in terms of international trade.
Well, an exchange rate is simply a price of a currency. That's all it is, right? It's just a price. And by devaluing their currency a little bit, it offsets some of the tariffs, which is, I guess, what you'd expect to do. However, it also makes goods that they buy more expensive, and that's a problem. And you know, if they're buying stuff from the U.S., they're offsetting the tariff a little bit, but the overall price is going up, and that's a problem for the economy, for their economy. It's a problem for us too, but it's a problem for their economy. For the U.S. dollar, the dollar's strong. It's been strong. You know, we're the world's economy. We're the world's currency. Most trade happens in U.S. dollars. The amount of trade that happens in Chinese yuan is pretty minuscule compared. So from that perspective, a strong dollar, you know, it's good for the world economy. A good, strong, stable dollar is good for the economy, for the world economy. But in terms of, you know, how is this trade with China, trade war, going to affect the exchange rates? It'll affect the yuan dollar, but I don't think it's going to be much more than that.
Is there a way to replace, realistically, the trade relationship between the United States and China? This is a huge economy we're dealing with. We're a big economy, too. We're one and two, and maybe those roles will be reversed in the relatively near future. So is there a replacement for that market in China? And if so, where?
that's a very interesting and good question. For some sectors, you know, take soybeans. Yeah, that's one of the most important ones for North Dakota. Where else can we sell beans? We can sell soybean meal to Asia. They want to buy soybean meal. But there aren't a lot of places we can sell a lot of soybeans. So that's until we restructure things, finding alternative markets is going to be really hard. For other sectors, you know, you look at like the automobile industry. They've invested heavily in China. They have facilities there, manufacturing facilities.
And they have huge tariffs in China, that they like 25% or so, isn't it, for a car that's being sold in China?
Well, it depends on who your partner is, and it depends on where it was actually manufactured.
Again, that's the complexity.
That's
of trade.
The complexity. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's can we find alternative markets for some things? Absolutely. For others, it'll be much more difficult. The problem is that, you know, we've spent, particularly in agriculture, we've spent millions and millions and millions of dollars over the years developing those markets, developing those relationships, you know, convincing people we're a reliable supplier of high-quality products. And we just shot ourselves in the foot.
Well, it seems that this trade war, particularly as it applies to soybeans and some other commodities, has caused a severe enough disruption in that China is developing other places to get soybeans from. So the world market for soybeans is likely to go through quite a significant shift, isn't it?
I think that's true. They've just announced that they're buying soybean meal from Argentina. They've invested heavily in Brazil as a source of soybeans. You know, they're looking at changing their supply chain, where they're getting stuff from. They're never going to allow the U.S. to be that important of a supplier to them again. That's part of the problem of a trade war, is you convince the world that you're an unreliable supplier. And they're going to find other sources. Yes, we may get some soybean market back, and probably will eventually, and maybe some of the pork market too. But they're going to diversify their sources because we've proven that we're not the reliable supplier we claim to be.
And as a result, soybean producers might have to go to some other kind of crop, might they not?
Well, they're going to have to look really hard at what's going to be profitable. And, you know, their crop mix is maybe going to change.
Thomas Wall is a professor in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at NDSU. We're talking about the ongoing trade war between China and the United States. And, Tom, you mentioned the, you know, who's building the car kind of thing. And that puts another wrinkle in this discussion because President Trump has talked many times in many public appearances about the importance of rebuilding the manufacturing sector in the United States economy. But the reality is these are multinational companies who actually manufacture where it makes the most business sense for them. And a lot of them are manufacturing in China.
That's absolutely true. You know, Ford Motor Company is an example. They were forced to make develop relationships with several different entities to build cars in China. They were forced to transfer technology. And now there's sort of some infighting going on from what I read between those different companies they work with, what models they get to sell or don't get to sell. And then layered on top of that is they can't backfill models with from the U.S. now because of the big tariffs. Another example is BMW, you know, German company. They were building their small SUVs in the U.S. and exporting them to China. That was a very lucrative market there. There are lots of those BMW SUVs running around in China. But now because of the tariffs, that market's pretty much gone from them. And you know, their plant in the U.S., which was great for us, I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, it makes a really good stump speech, but the reality here seems to be very complicated because if you say, well, the solution is to move that manufacturing point in China to the United States, the logistics and the reality of that sort of seem daunting.
Well, yeah, for the automobile industry, you know, there's so much investment that it probably makes absolutely no sense to move it back to the U.S. But for other companies like that make, you know, the stuff we buy at Christmas, the toys and so forth, they're not coming back to the U.S. They're going to go to Vietnam. They're going to go to Indonesia because they're a much lower cost production.
And they're currently doing that now.
Yeah, definitely.
But the iPhone, for example, there's a great example because that's made in China largely.
Yeah. I was reading where the city where they make most of the iPhones, they actually call it iPhone City. And, you know, Apple has started to talk about shifting production to other places to diversify their sources because of those tariffs and the problems associated with the tariffs.
So this problem we have, this trade war, which has really grown and gotten more intense, belies a long-standing relationship the U.S. has had with China.
Mm-hmm.
That has not been adversarial as much as it's been synergistic. I mean, I understand that there are differences of opinion in both these countries, but China and the U.S. kind of need each other, don't they?
Well, in many ways we're very much linked. It's very much a synergistic relationship. We're a good market for them, and they've been buying a lot of our bonds and investments. And, you know, how is that going to change? You know, if we diversify our sources of – instead of buying stuff from China, we go to Vietnam or Indonesia or other places, how does that affect their economy? And what does that do to their investment in our bonds and our bond markets and our products, agricultural products? Those things are going to shift.
You mentioned a while back that we do have differences, significant differences with China, and we'll get into some of that. But we also have structures. The World Trade Organization, for example, which is kind of a worldwide free trade organization. Let's reduce barriers. Let's get products moving back and forth with as much ease as possible to stir economic growth everywhere. Are these organizations just out of the picture right now?
Well, let me say the World Trade Organization, as a trade economist, I think that was one of our greatest inventions, having some body that could kind of set the rules for trading and make people adhere to them. Right now, I mean, the negotiations in the WTO are ongoing in a lot of areas and will continue. It'll continue to exist. But its importance is certainly being downplayed in the U.S. right now. We're sort of ignoring the rules. We're doing what we want to. We're not adhering to practices that promote trade.
In the previous administration, and I think it was somewhat bipartisan, there was a fair amount of discussion about putting together a Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade organization that would deal more directly with the differences we had with China by creating a coalition in Southeast Asia and in Australia, those kinds of places, that would allow us to put a little leverage on China. That blew up immediately with the new administration. So give us your analysis of that and whether or not it was a good idea.
I think TPP had the potential to bring China into line with the rest of the world in terms of trade and how they were behaving with relationship to international organizations, their banking system. I think a lot of that could have been brought into alignment. TPP had the potential to be a fantastic shift towards free and open trade and would have been very, 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 very beneficial to the U.S. The fact that we're no longer a partner, well, maybe someday we will be again. But right now there's a lot of Asia, Canada, Mexico that are enjoying all the benefits of TPP, and we're missing out completely.
The travels I've had the benefit of being in Thailand and Singapore and Indonesia and Vietnam. And one thing I've seen in that part of the world, particularly in Vietnam in my recollection in Thailand, is unbridled capitalism. I mean, it is absolutely crazy busy. So there is a part of the world, I think, out there that does offer some opportunity. It's just not the size of China.
That's absolutely true. I've never been to Vietnam, but I've been to all those other countries and traveled to China many, many times. And my observation is in that part of the world, if you give people a chance to make a buck, they're going to go for it. They're very entrepreneurial. And that presents a lot of opportunities. You know, China has historically presented an opportunity for exporters. But the idea that you're going to sell $1.4 billion of anything and that's your goal, that's not the right attitude. You want to go there to develop a relationship, develop a market, and sell high-quality products, not necessarily $1.4 billion of them.
Well, there's something else here I think that sort of gets lost in the discussion about trade, and that is the way that trade, this kind of economic relationship, can tamp down other issues that could result in real conflict. Expand on that idea. I know you're not a geopolitical scientist, but trade is an important leveling process.
Well, one of the classes I teach is called export management, and one of the things we talk about is finding a good partner in the country you want to go into and developing trust and developing, the first time you sell over there, you might demand cash before you even ship. And as your relationship develops, you develop trust and develop a normal trading relationship. And as we trade with the rest of the world, that trust develops. And when you have partners that you trust and that it's mutual trust, it's much less likely to blow things up, right? If there's a problem, you fix it. If there's a problem, you address it. You don't go to war over it because they're your trading partners. They're your friends, your colleagues, they're the people that you're in business with. And you really don't want to ruin the relationship.
Thomas Wall is a professor in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at NDSU. We're talking about the ongoing trade war with China, and we'll be back with more of our discussion after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. In a little over a year, if you wish to board in a commercial airplane, you will need a Real ID compliant form. That includes Real ID compliant driver's licenses. Lori Dankers is with the Transportation Security Administration.
In a nutshell, Real ID is the way that the federal government knows you are who you say you are on your photo identification.
Dankers says other Real ID forms include passports and military ID. So far, 83,000 North Dakotans have a Real ID compliant driver's license.
If you do not have a compliant form of identification and you come to the security checkpoint, you will not be granted access to the security checkpoint and you will not be allowed to board your flight. This has real consequences for people who do not plan ahead. This deadline will sneak up on all of us, and that's why we're talking about it today.
To get a real ID, you need to bring proof that you are a resident of the United States, proof of your Social Security number, and proof of your North Dakota residence. The acceptable forms are listed on the website dot.nd.gov/real-id. Scientists at Washington University in St. Louis and the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center are studying how high levels of carbon dioxide from human activities could affect crops. For Harvest Public Media, Ellie Chen reports that researchers are watching how some plants respond to increased levels of the greenhouse gas in growth chambers.
Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are higher than they've been in 800,000 years. Scientists predict they'll keep rising and worsening the effects of climate change. So Danforth Center researchers planted rice, tomatoes, and other plants inside growth chambers. Then they raised the levels of carbon dioxide to concentrations we might expect in a century or two. Danforth Center researcher Keith Slotkin says there aren't a lot of studies that look at how plants and their offspring will be affected by increasing carbon dioxide.
So we really don't know what we're going to expect, and that's part of what's really exciting about the project.
The National Science Foundation provided a $3 million grant for the four-year study. I'm Eli Chen.
And the Vice President for Congressional and Public Affairs with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spoke to the Greater North Dakota Chamber's Policy Summit in Bismarck. Ronald Eidzog outlined the top issues for the business community. They are
Trade, USMCA, trade, tariffs, trade, and infrastructure.
Eidzog says right now trade is, as he put it, sucking all the air out of the room.
We have a big vote coming up on getting the U.S.-Canada-Mexico free trade agreement done. That is really, really important. I think that's going to be the big push for the business community between now and Thanksgiving. That's really, really important to get done. We also want to see the administration move forward to figure out a resolution to the tariff situation with China. That's very, very important.
Eidzog says the U.S. Chamber also wants to see Congress move on an infrastructure bill. He says he is optimistic the USMCA measure will pass. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio again by Tom Wall. He's a professor in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at NDSU. We're talking about the trade war between the United States and China, which has been going on now for over a year and which has raised political temperatures on both sides of the Pacific and certainly is a big issue for North Dakota because we're an ag commodity economy and that means, in our case, a lot of soybeans aren't going to China. Tom, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Let's get into some of the real specifics we have with China about their trade practices, because we've been talking about the strained relationship here. But let's get a little bit into the weeds here about what they do that we don't like.
Well, part of it is a big part of it is the technology transfer and the fact that if you're going to go and set up a business there, and historically, you've had to have a Chinese partner that somebody from the Chinese government agreed to, basically.
It's the nature of the way they do business.
Yeah, it's what they required. And although that's been relaxed a little bit, I hear now that you're actually able to set up a business without having a Chinese partner in some areas, in some industries. But generally, it's still required. And as part of that partnership, you had to transfer technology. So if you're a car company, you have to bring your technology. Now, most companies wouldn't bring their latest technology, but maybe two or three generations old, but you still were forced to transfer that technology if you wanted to produce there.
Giving them some very valuable insight.
Exactly. And then in terms of the way they've subsidized certain sectors in direct subsidies in terms of allowing markets, developing markets, and through the banking sector, subsidizing companies to start in certain industries has been a very big part of the way they've grown their economy. To some degree, they've focused on exports by subsidizing bank loans and so forth in particular sectors to companies that maybe shouldn't have had it. State-owned enterprises were encouraged to, produce for exports. And, they maybe weren't the most efficient, and the most efficient ones aren't necessarily the ones that survived.
And with a centrally coordinated economy like the Chinese communists have, it is possible, I suppose, it clearly is possible to subsidize in a way that a place like the United States can't. That's just the scheme, the governmental scheme, if you will. Countries have different kinds of governments. We've had these issues with Canada on occasion, I know, about subsidies for various products. So how serious is that?
Well, it's in some ways maybe not at all, but in many ways it is because the underlying like the banking sector in China is in potentially serious problems. You know, think back to our housing crisis, the housing loans and why they you know the loans were made to people that really shouldn't have gotten them. And in China, what's happened is those loans the government made or forced banks to or encouraged banks to loan in a particular sector to a company that never paid them back. So they sit with a huge number of loans that are, well, they're non-performing or maybe even not even earning interest. And that's a huge part of what they're carrying on their books. You know, from international standards, those banks would be broke. They'd be taken over by somebody else. Those businesses would be closed. They'd be bankrupt, assets auctioned off.
So these are basically government banks and under this scheme.
Yeah. There's mostly – the banking system started out as entirely government run, and there have been some private banks. And a couple of the banks that have been shut down recently or forced to merge, I think there was three of them, they were private banks.
Let's talk about the approach that the Trump administration has had toward these sort of trade issues. North American Free Trade Agreement was renegotiated and it's still pending final approval. Now it's called the USMCA, Mexico and Canada and us. How effective is just going country by country as opposed to forming coalitions or, for that matter, a WTO and tackling this in a broader sense?
It's a lot more work. It's a lot less effective. It depends on how good a negotiator you are, who you're negotiating with. Some countries that we may not have a lot of leverage with, but as a group, for example, with TPP, we may have had a lot of leverage as a group, whereas individually we don't. And that can be a problem. You know, if we're dealing only with other countries where, for whatever reason, we have a lot of leverage, more than a group perhaps, it may be beneficial. But in most cases, it's not true.
Well, let's talk about the USMCA, formerly known as NAFTA. Canada and Mexico are like one and two, the major trading partners with mm-hmm. North Dakota.
Yep.
How important is that agreement and what would you call the distinctions in the renegotiated plan?
Well, one of the interesting things I've heard about the new agreement is that it's pretty close to what TPP was, and which throws a really interesting twist on things. Now, there was some of the sectors, some of the agricultural products coming in. There were some safeguards put in place that hadn't been there before or were problematic, and those got changed a little bit. But generally speaking, the shift in the agreement is very much – looks very much like TPP would have.
And if it were to be finally ratified, that would be a good thing for North Dakota?
I think so. Having the agreement is better than not having the agreement. Is it substantially better than NAFTA for North Dakota? I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference. Even though we're on the border with Canada, there aren't a lot of things that go back and forth that are going to be substantially affected. Dairy products, but then again, we don't produce a lot of dairy. And certain other agricultural products may be some effect. But generally speaking, I don't think for North Dakota it's going to have a huge effect.
As I recall, maple syrup was on the list of things as well. Well, let's get back to China for a moment. Just recently, the Chinese relaxed tariffs. They announced they were relaxing tariffs on 16 various products, none of which are real germane to North Dakota, in advance of the talks that were supposed to occur in September. A lot of hype has been put up about these particular talks coming up as mm-hmm. though they might break the tide or somehow. What's your opinion of the next stage in negotiations?
Well, in these kinds of negotiations, one of the things is you really don't want to back somebody into a corner completely. You always need to give them a way out, to save face.
Xi's got over a billion people to say we did okay.
And he has to come away from a win somehow.
Yeah.
And Trump wants to come away with a win somehow. And finding a way to give a little and find some common ground has been very difficult, apparently. I think those 16 products that they lowered the tariffs on, I think was just a fig leaf or a branch to throw to sort of help the process along, perhaps.
So you're not putting high hopes in this? It's just an ongoing chat or what?
I'm afraid so.
Okay. Thomas Wall is a professor in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at NDSU. Thank you for coming by.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
I'm Jack Spear. Hundreds of stations across the country, just like this one, carry NPR programs. And every day, these same stations make sure you're informed about news happening in your state. That's because public radio is in a partnership with stations and NPR to provide you with national, international, and local news. From your city to your state capital, from Washington to Cairo, public radio brings you comprehensive and reliable information about your community and your world. And if that sounds like a lot, that's because we do a lot with your support. You can do a lot with a little, especially in public radio. So please consider becoming a sustaining member of your station today. And thanks.
That's an important message. You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. We're in our fall membership drive, and that word collaboration is a very public broadcasting word. We like to collaborate with people. With our listeners, for example, we like to collaborate with you. Give us some ideas. And with other newsrooms all across this state and across the country and around the world occasionally, we collaborate because that's what public is.
And we love our members so much, and so many of our listeners, too, are just... Boy, sometimes I think they listen a lot better than I do because they are calling in with little tips, little suggestions. They're very engaged, very well-informed listeners, and more than anything, curious and open-minded. That's an amazing listener to have. And then when you couple that with that understanding that they can help put this on the air and take a little bit of that responsibility and become a member. Oh, man, that's like pie for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. 1-800-359-4145 is the number to call to support that. And membership is the single largest slice of the revenue pie around here.
Yeah, it's important. As a matter of fact, that collaboration word is still ringing in my head, and I'm thinking, well, you know, that interview we just did with Tom Wall, a doctor of agribusiness at NDSU, and an important person in trade relations in this country and in the state, obviously, which is heavily impacted by international business right now. Well, I got his name from Frayn Olson. Wait, I interviewed Frayn Olson a couple of weeks ago about soybean growers.
Right.
And after the chat, we talked about, well, you know, there's more to this. And he said, well, you should talk to Tom Wall. He's an expert on trade and with China in particular. So that's how he came to us. We love to hear some advice, and we would love to hear what you think when you give us a call and become a member at Prairie Public. 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org. It doesn't take much time, but let me tell you, it's important. As Ashley said, members are the biggest piece of the pie, and we need a little more slice work there. We really do. Main Street and the other programs that you hear on Prairie Public rely very heavily on listener support, and that by that I mean those listeners who say, you know, what's coming to my ears is important enough for me to invest in, and so I'm going to become a member. For those of you who have, thank you. For those of you who are, maybe you could upgrade. For those of you who haven't, this is an important day for you and for us.
1-800-359-4145 to start that investment. Doug, I love to hear stories where you get a guest idea from another guest idea or from a listener, because that just affirms to us that these conversations are connecting on a deeper level. And to me, it just feels sometimes I get tired. If we have 3, 4, 5 interviews in a day, it gets hard to research that. When we hear from listeners, it makes it all worth it. We put in so much work into this labor of love, and to build that connection really is what it's all about here. 1-800-359-4145 is the number to call to get your membership going.
And the word of this hour has been collaboration. And Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at farm and rural issues. And we've got a story from them coming up here. Most of the corn grown in the United States goes into livestock feed and ethanol, the very important issues where we are. But people in the Midwest will literally wait in line for an ear of fresh, hot corn on the cob, and for that matter, anywhere in the country. It's a quintessential summer and fall snack. And Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer says sweet corn comes in many varieties, but most people don't know or care what they are.
Ajay Nair knows sweet corn.
There's one called Early Sun Glow.
He says farmers plant what sells.
There's one, a yellow color type. It's called Cafe.
But they also consider how quickly sugar is converted to starch, how long the ears last after harvest.
Another cultivar called Cuppa Joe.
Nair says consumers care mostly about sweetness, texture, and the intensity of the corn flavor.
We have Bodacious Silver Queen.
They don't pay a whole lot of attention to the name.
There's a cultivar called Temptation.
But the Iowa State University horticulture professor says one name has become almost synonymous with sugary, two-color sweet corn.
Peaches and cream. It's easy to say, easy to remember, and it's fun.
At the farmer's market in Ames, Iowa, Ray Olson does a brisk business with his sweet corn.
What's the difference?
That one's got a little more corn flavor. This one just isn't yellow. And this is probably the most popular, the bicolor.
Then how about that one?
He has this conversation again and again. Customers want yummy corn. Beyond that, most have little preference. But a few returning customers are more discerning.
You know, some of the corn is really rich. Like the examples down here, the ears or the corn kernels are really, you know, full and rich.
Glenda Storms Bice asks for smaller ears, ones Olson says are a little less mature.
I actually think the ones with a little smaller kernels are sometimes a little sweeter. They also get in your teeth a little less.
As she picks through a crate to select the ears she wants, Terry Flocker of Kansas City compares cooking strategies with her.
And I wrap it in like a burrito or whatever, and then get it wet, and then put it on the plate and just cook it in the microwave like that.
Oh, see, and I don't even peel mine before I put it in the microwave.
Versus, you know, back in the day when my mom would cook corn or whatever, you'd boil it and get the kitchen hot,
yes,
and steamy,
exactly.
And
moist.
And it's like,
you know, no.
Olson says he grows 6 varieties each year. He knows which he can plant earlier and which ones are most popular with customers who rarely know any of the names.
Okay.
Several stalls over, Deal's Orchard has a sign declaring the week's sweet corn is a variety called Christine. Benji Deal says it's done well for him.
It's our sweetest variety that we grow. It's a bicolor. Nice and tender. I think it's a little more tender than some other varieties.
Deal says a few customers will ask for a variety by name, but more often they choose by color.
Today I saved 6 ears for someone because they're almost all out, and so I knew she always stopped by and wants the all yellow.
Midwest states that lead in field corn production, think Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, don't stand out when it comes to national production of sweet corn. The Iowa Corn Promotion Board says sweet corn accounts for just 1% of corn grown in the state. Still, for hungry attendees on the final Friday of the Iowa State Fair, it's the only kind that matters.
Thank you, sir. You are very helpful. Thank you so much.
A boy hands out napkins to people in line for a free ear of corn. It comes on a paper plate from an FFA teen. Fair volunteer Mary Smith squirts margarine from a squeeze bottle onto the corn for those who want it. Most people also stop at a table to shake on some salt. Wade and Stella Hardiman came to Iowa for a family reunion.
Delicious.
Yeah.
Very delicious.
Really sweet. It's my first time.
Richard Wagaman of Essex, Iowa, may have a more refined palate than some.
So I don't know what, it kind of tastes like ambrosia, but it may be some other brand. They've got so many now. But could be peaches and cream or something like that, but it's very good.
It's first come, first served until they run out. John Carpenter from Kansas City waits in line with his fiancée. He declares the corn incredible.
I'll be moving to Iowa to have more of this sweet corn as often as I'd like.
Now I'm going to find a place to eat my corn. That is definitely an ear of Iowa sweet corn.
But what kind was it? Farmer Ron Deerdorf, who grew it, isn't telling. He says anything beyond the obvious, by color, is proprietary information. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative. Coming up, Dakota Datebook.
I first became a member of Prairie Public when we moved back to North Dakota in 2007. We are members of Prairie Public because we love to listen to the diverse programming. We particularly love the Moth Radio Hour, StoryCorps, and just the different diverse perspectives. I have many driveway moments listening to Prairie Public, particularly with the Moth Radio Hour. I just can't seem to tear myself away without hearing how the story ends. And I just love the complete picture that Prairie Public paints for stories that are presented. I love the sustaining membership option of Prairie Public because it allows me to think about one less thing. I know that I'm contributing to Prairie Public every month, and it's not something I have to think about. I love knowing that my family and I are contributing to Prairie Public to help maintain the stories that you hear. I'm Erica Berg from Kindred, North Dakota, and I'm a proud sustaining member of Prairie Public.
Support all the things you love about Prairie Public by making a sustaining membership contribution. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 11th. On this date, in 1908, the Washburn Leader explained how the town of Burlington got its name. The site for the town was prompted by a visit to the area in the spring of 1883 by Joseph Colton and James Johnson. At the fork of the Des Lacs and Mouse Rivers, they noticed a coal outcropping and thought the location was promising. Colton established a mine there. By 1884, there were only five settlers in the area, so Colton's mining business was off to a slow start. But by 1886, the number of settlers and the demand for coal had grown. And as the railroad moved west, coal became an increasingly valuable commodity. After Colton passed away, Johnson got the idea to establish a post office and name it Colton after his friend. When Johnson submitted a petition, he learned there was already a Dakota Territory post office named Colton. The assistant postmaster general was the editor of a newspaper in Burlington, Iowa, and he suggested the name of Burlington. Johnson set out on a mission to get the required number of petition signatures for the Burlington post office. He found it hard going. He even got a signature from Pat Connor, who lived 75 miles away. Next, he went to John Satterland, who also signed. But another local settler, Charles Willer, refused to sign because he was planning to petition for a post office named after himself, Willer. There were few other settlers in the area, and Johnson began to despair of ever getting his post office. Then Colonel Lounsbury, helped by rounding up signers from Bismarck and the Burlington post office, was born. In the early days of the office, traveling settlers would often carry the mail. Finally, a carrier was hired for $50 a month. He delivered on horseback in good weather and by dog sled in winter. On one trip, the dogs got hungry and ate the harness, which interfered with the service. Burlington became a growing concern, with coal mines, a brickyard, a spur of the Soo Line, a hotel, and boarding houses. The coal mines began to play out in the 1920s, and two fires destroyed most of the town. Two banks closed during the 1930s Depression, but the Burlington Post Office is still located on Colton Avenue. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves, and I enjoy traveling with you right here on Prairie Public. When I travel, I value convenience, and becoming a sustaining donor is the most convenient way to support Prairie Public. Automatic payments set up the way you like. It's easy. It's easy for you and for Prairie Public. So keep traveling and become a sustaining member today. Call 800-359-4145 or go online at prairiepublic.org.
Well, that's a very friendly voice and a guy who's lots of fun to listen to. And you can listen to him tonight on Travel with Rick Steves on the Prairie Public Radio Network at 8 Central. He's been in our studio, Ashley.
He has because, you know, he didn't become one of these, oh, I have my own TV show, I'm too good to talk to anybody kind of guys. No, he is still out there very passionate about what he does and loves to meet fans and get some tips for his own show. 1-800-359-4145 is the number to call to invest in Prairie Public, a show like Rick Steves as you travel around the world. Doesn't it sound so funny to have a travel show on radio?
Not to me, because I love listening to this. Yeah. I like to travel. I know you do too.
I do too. And I just, you can do it from your own kitchen.
Vicariously.
Yeah, and it's so great because he finds these little things that you might not know how to find on your own, probably because he knows how to value convenience, and so he makes what doesn't need to be difficult easy, and then that gives him more time to be creative in his travel. So take his advice, get that sustaining membership, and that will save you just enough time to be an even better traveler when you call 1-800-359-4145.
And of course, during our membership drives, we try to offer some incentives for those people who may be thinking, well, give me another nudge. Well, if you're starting a sustaining membership for the first time, you would qualify to have your contribution matched dollar for dollar by the Newman's Own Foundation. So that's an incentive that's additional today that we want to make sure you understand. So make that $10 a month count even more, because it becomes an additional $120 over the year for Prairie Public. So that one-time gift of $120, Newman's Own doubles that to $240. That's a wow thing there. And it's easy to do. You just pick up the phone and give us that call, 800-359-4145, or you go online to prairiepublic.org. The most important thing is you're collaborating with us for the radio you're listening to. You're investing in Main Street and the other programming you hear on Prairie Public. And for that, we're very thankful because we need you.
Doug, you mentioned that $10 a month gift level. We have this great Prairie Public pint glass, so it has the Prairie Public logo, and then it also has some North Dakota icons on it, like the Western Meadowlark and a singing cowboy and a bison on there. And, of course, as we start to get into cooler temperatures, it's nice to think about a good craft beer in there, a dark, smoky, maybe chocolatey one. I know what I'm doing after work.
I'm a lager Kolsch guy.
You know, I like the stouts. I just do. I like stouts and porters. But it doesn't matter because it's an empty glass. You can put what you want in it. 1-800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org.
And for those of you who have, really, from Ashley in my heart, thank you very much.
We love you.
Coming up on Main Street on Thursday, the Heritage Education Commission's 44th Annual Family History Workshop is coming up, and we'll discuss genealogy and that workshop with the Commission's President, Margaret Zarin. Sue Balcom will join us with a discussion of farmers market etiquette on our Main Street Eats segment, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. We hope you'll consider becoming a member of Prairie Public and making this show, you know, sustain itself on the air, coming to you every day. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.